The events. Reach out for international solidarity.
The time is now 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lentz International Farmers Market, a program of Zinger Farm, every Sunday through October at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Lentz Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for kids, a community table, cooking demonstrations, and live music. More at lentzfarmersmarket.org. And by the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And also by Northwest Documentary, a nonprofit dedicated to providing filmmaking education and helping students make a movie in just 10 weeks. Classes start next week, and more information is available at 503-227-8688 or online at nwdocumentary.org. Right now, the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the police chief in Ferguson, Missouri, officially apologizes for the shooting of unarmed teenager Michael Brown.
The United States continues its airstrikes in Syria.
And Oregon student debt has doubled in the last decade.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 26th, 2014. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Liam Delta. In Ferguson, Missouri, protests followed yesterday's apology by the city's police chief to the family of Michael Brown. The chief of police, Tom Jackson, made a public apology yesterday concerning the shooting, a month and a half after the event. In the video, he apologizes to the Brown family for the loss of their son, the 4 hours he lay dead in the road, and subsequent actions by the police arresting journalists and peaceful protesters. The video was made available on a very limited basis. A public relations firm released it only to CNN and posted it on a video sharing website. After St. Louis 3rd Ward Committeeman Anthony Bell viewed the clip, he said it was too little, too late. Bell spent time arguing with Chief Jackson at the scene of Brown's death while Brown lay dead in the street. The apology came as Brown's parents were in D.C. with representatives from the NAACP asking for the U.S. Department of Justice to take up the investigation of the killing. The Missouri grand jury proceedings could go on for months before charges could be filed, if they're filed at all. Brown's parents want police officer Darren Wilson to be charged for Michael Brown's death. No charges have yet been filed. Later yesterday evening, Chief Jackson joined mourners and protesters on the street outside the police station. He walked with the crowd after pledging to make changes in the way police handle protesters. But soon after the police chief left, police began to enter the crowd, knocking people down and arresting seven of them. Dozens of protesters and journalists have been arrested in the last 7 weeks of protests in Ferguson.
And now we move from one police shooting of an African-American man to another. KBOO's Ryan Katz reports on the case of John Crawford near Dayton, Ohio.
On August 5th, a 22-year-old man named John Crawford entered a Walmart in Beaver Creek, Ohio. He was with his girlfriend, and they were looking for materials for a cookout. Surveillance footage from the Walmart cameras shows him picking up a pellet gun off of the shelf. And then this happened.
A man named Ronald Ritchie was in the store and called 911 and said, there's a black male in the store. He's waving a gun around. He's pointing it at children.
That's Dashiell Kaur. She's an organizer for the Ohio Student Association. We now know, says Kaur, that this was a lie.
At the moment when the 911 caller said he was pointing the gun at children, he was in an aisle completely by himself. There was no one even around him.
The police, responding to the call, enter the store.
The way they start their walk in, they're, you know, you see them get low to the ground as if they're in a war situation. They kind of creep up on him, you know, with their knees bent close to the ground, and then they just start shooting.
John Crawford later died in an area hospital. And Kaur says that after the shooting, the reaction was a bit mixed.
People, you know, were a little bit more hesitant to make a call on what happened because they had only heard the narrative of the 911 caller at that point, that he was pointing it at children and stuff like that. Now that the video is out, people who had faith in the justice system are losing it, and people who already didn't have faith in the justice system are just, you know, confirmed even more angry. Everyone who was waiting to be angry is angry.
In response to the community outrage surrounding the shooting, Attorney General Mark DeWine appointed a special prosecutor from Cincinnati to convene a grand jury on the case. The purpose of the grand jury was to see if there was any evidence to charge the police officers in this case. Again, here's Dashiell Kaur.
The way grand juries work is the prosecutor is in total control of what evidence is brought in and how the evidence is presented. That man's name is Mark Pietmeyer. Mark Pietmeyer was actually the prosecutor in a case in 2001 in Cincinnati of a police shooting an unarmed teenager. That case ended up in race riots in Cincinnati because there was no justice brought to the case.
To the surprise of few, the grand jury did not find evidence to indict the police in the shooting of John Crawford.
Pietmeyer also was the one who told the community about the end result of the grand jury. To my group and the people who were there, it really felt like he was a defense attorney rather than a prosecutor. He was doing whatever he could to, you know, explain away and defend the police officer's actions rather than trying to prosecute him.
3 weeks before the shooting of John Crawford, Eric Garner was killed after being placed in a chokehold on Staten Island by a New York City police officer. 4 days after Crawford, Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, Missouri. 2 days after that, Azelle Ford was lying on the ground after being investigated by the Los Angeles Police Department when he was shot and killed. People like Dashiell Kaur says this has to stop.
This goes from local to state to national. Obviously, this is a national epidemic, so I do think that there needs to be actions taken on the national level by the National Department of Justice. But then on a local level and a state level, you know, you can look more at how the police are trained and really what is the relationship between the police and the communities that they are supposed to be serving.
Earlier this month, the New York Times came out with an article detailing the race gap in American police departments. Ferguson, Missouri, where Michael Brown was shot, has a plus 55% of more white police officers than residents. Maple Heights, near Cleveland, Ohio, is more than 70%. And here in the Pacific Northwest, in Kent, Washington, near Seattle, there's a difference of 39%. The town of Beaver Creek is primarily white. Out of the 47 active police officers in Beaver Creek, there is one black female and one black male officer. But Dashiell Kaur says that more and more, residents of the Dayton area are traveling to Beaver Creek to do their shopping.
Part of our solution needs to be that police needs to be reflective of the greater Dayton community. That means the city, all of the suburbs around there, the schools, the universities that are near there, you know, it needs to be representative of all of that. And then the police need to serve all of those people.
This is Ryan Katz with KBU News.
A worker for the state of Oregon who was fired after complaining that co-workers left a noose on his desk has been reinstated with back pay. Gene Summerfield was fired from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the OLCC, 2 years ago. An arbitrator for the Labor Relations Board found that OLCC dismissed him unfairly. Summerfield had called attention to co-workers creating a hostile environment by making racist remarks and gestures, including leaving a noose at his workstation. After he was fired, Summerfield filed a claim with the Bureau of Labor and Industry and later filed a workman's compensation claim for undue stress and a lawsuit. Last year, after a defense launched by the Oregon Department of Justice acting for the OLCC, which aimed to smear Summerfield's credibility, the court found he was fired for being a whistleblower but did not award monetary compensation. He will get back pay with interest and benefits and will be reinstated at his prior job level.
A Portland community leader facing deportation has spent the last 7 days in sanctuary at a local church. Francisco Aguirre from the Vaz Workers' Rights Center headed to the Augustana Lutheran Church with a group of his supporters after ICE agents showed up at his door. He has no idea how long he'll need to remain in the church. Francisco spoke with Cable's Jenka Soderberg today, along with the pastor of Augustana and supporters.
Good evening. My name is Diana Peiwu. I'm the media coordinator for the Coalition Unidos con Francisco, and I'm here with Pastor Mark Knutson from the Augustana Lutheran Church, with Francisco Aguirre, who's been in sanctuary for a week, and Marco Mejia, who is on the board of the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice. I think Francisco can speak to that the best. So, Francisco?
Hello, my name is Francisco. The update right now, it's this media crisis is gone. Immigration or ICE, it's already saying that they're not going to come and detain me. They will respect the agreement they have, you know, with churches, you know, sensitive place, you know, for them that they're not going to come in. But still, you know, that question is that I'm still here, thinking when this going to end, and there is not a clear answer if it's going to be a month, years.
And I understand that a deportation order comes out of a drug charge from 1998 when you were 19 years old.
I don't think I'm under a deportation. I'm under a U visa process.
And what does that mean? What's the difference?
The difference is that U visa is for a victim of a crime, and that's what I'm asking ICE to respect my process. And on one hand, there is immigration continuing with my U visa process, and in the other side, ICE is trying to interfere with my process.
Have immigration officials come to the church at all?
Not that we know.
How are members of the community supporting you?
It's amazing. Faith community in general, it's really supporting me 100%, not only local, but national and international. They are in my support.
What does it mean to have someone in sanctuary at a church? And maybe the pastor of the church, if he's there, would be able to answer.
Well, realistically, that happens every day, all year long. Everybody that walks into a church, a synagogue, a mosque, a temple, needs to feel safe. And to the world is what God intended, that the whole world be safe for every human being. So, but in this particular case, it's different because not everybody who walks in to seek help or guidance or love, basically, has to worry about walking outside the doors and having a government agency ready to take them, pull them away from their family, their job, their community, and deport them with no recourse. And that's the difference. And so for us as a church, it means this church has grown from 200 to 900 the last 16, 17 years now, but everybody was joined. It's like training. You are ready. And they knew when they joined that we are a sanctuary, and we knew this day would come in this kind of a case. And so they are fully behind it. They are doing whatever they can. All 900 members are out in the community today and all week long, affecting other opinions and talking to people in good dialogue. And 15,000 people a day, if you factor it out, are in contact with our members. So that's it. But I do want to stress especially that the interfaith community and the community itself in this city has risen up together. It's not what you read in the stories, but when you have all the nonprofits, and I started naming them from the Urban League to the right on down the line is stepping up. And so that's the thrilling thing, to see community power, faith, and people of goodwill rising up and saying, this is wrong. This is a human being. And I would say, you know, a child of God, made in God's image, whose face is a possibility ripped from his family. And he's given so much to this community. And so my prayer always is that we will always see the gifts of one another as pure gift and come at it differently. Oregonians are good people, I think, and so are Portlanders. And so let's go to our higher ground and welcome one another rather than deport or put people in fear.
Is this the first time that someone has sought sanctuary of this form at Augustana?
It's one of the first times in the state in this form. My belief, my understanding is that some have been in sanctuary, but with churches, but in houses. So I think it's one of the first times in the state that it's in a sanctuary itself. And so actually, Francisco then slept in the worship space the first 2 days by intent. We wanted him there because we thought if anybody with weapons would come into a house of prayer for all people, we are at a major crisis in this nation. That did not happen. Now he's in a nice room within the sanctuary, the whole church is sanctuary. And so it is the first time, but we've been preparing for 19 years.
And if people want to get involved, how can they do that?
I'm going to have you talk to Marco Mejia, because he's with Emerge, and which is housed here, was one of our nonprofits, we're proud to say. And he'll tell you how people can get involved.
Yeah, hi. The ways that people can get involved in supporting Francisco, and as Pastor Knudsen said, the community in general, is a number of those. I will name some of them. First, we want everyone to come out on Tuesday night. We will be surrounding Francisco and his family with an interfaith and community show of support. We need as many folks as possible, and hope to attract media attention, like you, like Cable. We hope that you can come. And so it will start, the doors will open at 6 p.m., and we will have a program that will start at 7 p.m. We will have also space for interviews. The date is Tuesday, next week, on September 30th. And the location is here at Augustana Lutheran Church, which is 2710 Northeast 14th Avenue.
And then this is Diane again. We just have, you know, as the coalition here supporting Francisco, we really have two wishes. And the first one is that Francisco can be successfully reunited with his family, that they're safe here in Portland and in our city, and that nationally we are able to pass real, just, and humane immigration reform. That this is so important for the safety and security of so many families in this country.
Well, thank you so much, Diana Wu, and, of course, Francisco Aguirre, who has sought sanctuary at the Augustana Lutheran Church. We also spoke with Pastor Knudsen and Marco Mejia. Thank you all so much for joining us on KBOO today. And the website, if you are wanting to support monetarily, is GoFundMe.com/ERRCPW. This is Jinka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
A longtime Radical Bookstore Collective has received a notice to vacate their storefront location by this coming Monday. The Laughing Horse Collective notified KBOO Radio this morning that they've received their final eviction notice and will not be fighting it. The collective plans a goodbye party tonight, and they'll turn in their keys on Monday. But several members of the Laughing Horse Collective have accrued $3,000 in debt, and they're asking for community support to help pay it off. More information can be found on the group's Facebook page under the group Laughing Horse PDX.
Today, the judge overseeing the state of Oregon's lawsuit against the Oracle Corporation withdrew from the case. Marion County Circuit Court Judge Cheryl Pellegrini decided not to hear the case because it would have been inappropriate. She did not provide any further explanation. But a communications manager at the Oregon Judicial Department stated that Judge Pellegrini led that department's trial division shortly before her appointment as judge in this February. The state's representation is being overseen by the Oregon Department of Justice, which is Pellegrini's former employer. The case will now be assigned to Judge Cortland Geyer, who was chosen at random
within Marion County's circuit court system. In May, Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber asked the state's Department of Justice to sue Oracle over Oregon's failed healthcare exchange website.
It's getting harder to graduate from college in Oregon without going deeply into debt. That's because state funding for higher education has dropped so low that Oregon is now number 47th in the nation. An analysis by the Oregonian of federal student loan data shows students at Oregon's colleges and their parents borrowed $1.3 billion last year for their education, double the level from a decade ago. Last year, more than 60% of Oregon's college graduates left school owing more than $26,000. The number of Oregonians at Oregon's public four-year institutions actually declined over the last 2 years and now stands at the lowest level since 2009. Community colleges are shedding students at a much faster rate, some suffering 20 to 30% enrollment declines. A college degree, on average, bestows a lifetime earnings advantage of $1 million over those without a degree, according to the Oregonian report. That would seem to make a debt level of $26,000 a sound investment, but the economic benefit of college shrinks sharply if you don't get a degree, which happens to 40% of students who enroll at Oregon's seven public schools.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's going to be Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 73 degrees. Sunday, we'll see a similar pattern with a high of 77 degrees. Today, in history, a group of protesters shut down the court in Springfield, Massachusetts, which started the standoff that led to Shay's Rebellion back in 1786. On September 26th of 1960, Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy held the first nationally televised presidential debate. On that same day, Fidel Castro announced Cuba's support for the Soviet Union. The quote of the day comes from Thomas Jefferson, who, when writing to James Madison about Shay's Rebellion, said, "A little rebellion now and then is a good thing."
It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Now here's a dinner I wish I could have attended. According to Associated Press, it was an elegant evening of fine dining in New York City's très chic Tribeca neighborhood. Celebrity chefs prepared a sumptuous spread of international cuisines for this truly unique ballet for the taste buds. The feast was called, quote, a transforming dining experience. Actually, it was not so much transforming as it was mind-bending. The dinner was hosted by McDonald's. The fast food mega chain of cheap eats was making yet another stab at enhancing its image, this time by trying to convince reporters that its food is actually healthy, fresh, high quality, even worthy of gourmet dining. Thus, the scribes were treated to such dressed-up dishes as Kung Pao chicken made with the chain's chicken McNuggets, enoki made with McDonald's French fries, and a pumpkin spice dessert fashioned from its biscuit mix. The closest I've come to such culinary pretension was years ago when I reluctantly agreed to judge a spam cooking contest, choking down bites of spam fricassee, coquille Saint spam, and spam spumoni. It was the food equivalent of dressing a pig in an evening gown. Some things are simply what they are, and it's best that we not pretend to fancy them up. Nonetheless, McDonald's richly paid honchos keep trying to elevate their corporate image from fast food purveyors of fat and sugar to, as the Tribeca Gourmet event tried to claim, an Epicurean establishment offering good food served fast. Their attempts, though, are all smoke and mirrors, rhetoric and stunts. The CEO proclaims nonsense like this: "We've got to make sure the food is relevant." This is Jim Hightower saying, get real. Whether trying to gloss over its exploitation of low-wage workers or its health-challenging Big Macs, the McDonald's image won't change until the corporation does.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Today, the radio program This American Life released a program detailing a culture of corruption inside of the Federal Reserve, also known as the Fed. Carmen Segarra worked for the Federal Reserve, which is the governmental agency assigned with regulating investment banks. While there, Segarra secretly taped meetings between the Fed and one of the biggest investment banks, Goldman Sachs. The over 46 hours of tape provide overwhelming evidence that the Federal Reserve is a capture regulator, one that tends to serve the companies it is supposed to be supervising. Segarra describes that in meetings, the Fed employees would defer to Goldman employees and censor any alarming comments made by the investment bank. In one instance, a Goldman employee said, "Once our clients are wealthy enough, certain consumer laws just don't apply to them." In response, a fellow Fed regulator told her that she didn't hear that statement. Segarra was also asked to change meeting minutes after the meeting occurred to delete certain damaging information. Critics say this comes as no surprise. The president of the New York Federal Reserve at the time was William Dudley, an ex-partner at Goldman Sachs. Henry Paulson, the former secretary of the United States Treasury, was chief executive at Goldman Sachs for 8 years.
New information has emerged around the hiring scandal of Professor Stephen Salata of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Salata was initially hired to begin as a professor at the university this fall, but the offer was rescinded after he posted a number of items on Twitter criticizing the Israeli invasion of Gaza this summer. His supporters have challenged the university's version of events, and emails released recently, along with missing documents, have revealed a culture of corruption at the university that runs deeper than the case of Professor Salata. Recently, hundreds of pages of correspondence were released by the university under the Freedom of Information Act. Now, university officials say they can't find a key document that may shed light on donor pressure and organized efforts to smear Stephen Salata. The news website Electronic Intifada requested a copy of a memo on Salata's views under the Freedom of Information Act. The memo had been handed to Chancellor Phyllis Wise by a major donor to the university and helped lead to the decision to rescind his employment offer. But a September 18th letter from the university informed the Electronic Intifada that no records responsive to the request could be located. Under Illinois' law, Wise is required to preserve the document as a public record. Chancellor Wise and the university's subsequent refusal to answer any questions about the missing document, coupled with earlier contradictory statements about the Salata affair from President Robert Easter, gave rise to reasonable suspicion of a cover-up. There's separate evidence of a briefing document on Salata prepared by a major pro-Israel lobby group. Due to the university's lack of transparency, it has so far not been possible to determine if that document is the same one that was in Wise's possession and that the university claims it cannot find. The firing has generated national and international outrage from free speech and academic freedom advocates and a boycott of the University of Illinois endorsed by thousands of scholars.
The International Criminal Court has stated that they're ready to hear charges against the State of Israel for war crimes in Gaza. But the Palestinian president, who has the reputation of being a puppet of Western interests, has refused to bring the charges to the International Court. For more on this, we go to the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Speaking before the UN General Assembly, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said 2014 was meant to be a year of international solidarity with the Palestinians. However, Israel chose to make it a year of a new war of genocide perpetrated against the Palestinian people. Palestinian president, however, did not demand to try Israeli officials in international war crimes and was satisfied by slamming Israel for the failure of the peace negotiations. He said, quote, "There is neither credibility nor seriousness in negotiations in which Israel predetermines the results," unquote. President Abbas also said it is impossible to return to the cycle of negotiations that failed to deal with what he called the substance of the matter and the fundamental question, and ruled out chances to resume negotiations which the agreed objective is not ending the Israeli occupation and achieving the independence of the State of Palestine with East Jerusalem as its capital on the entire Palestinian territory occupied in the 1967 war with a clear and definite timetable. On Thursday, a resolution proposed by 18 Arab member states expressing concern about Israel's nuclear arsenal was defeated again at the annual general conference of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA. According to AFP, the measure was rejected by 58 votes to 45, with 27 countries abstaining. Israel is widely reputed to stockpile nuclear weapons on several accounts, but has never acknowledged the allegations. Israel is a member of the IAEA, but is not subject to their inspections. In the meantime, the Palestinian factions, including the two rival parties, Fatah and Hamas, resumed their reconciliation talks in Cairo this week. The Palestinian political factions have reached a comprehensive agreement on Thursday to implement the return of their unity government in Gaza. Egyptian sources said the negotiating groups were able to reach an agreement on a number of major points of discrepancy, including the Palestinian Authority's takeover of Rafah Crossing, as well as the adjacent Philadelphia corridor along the border. Additionally, an agreement has reportedly been reached on the issues of activating the Palestinian Authority's rule in Gaza and giving it the authority on paying the former Hamas employees' salaries and making decisions related to war and peace.